Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do the second session on the Protocols of Zion. We're dealing with pages 32 to 60. We'll cover this session, and this is more articles from Henry Fords, the great industrialist, the international Jew, that pertain to the protocols as we set it up before we get to the actual protocols themselves, which will take a couple more sessions as they're comparatively short and located in the middle of this book of some 300 pages. Let's get to it. An introduction to the Jewish protocols. We begin on page 32. Again, the red-orange book that you'll see is one of the more common copies of the Protocols of Zion, with preface and explanatory notes, it says on page, on the outer cover, nothing on the back. An introduction to the Jewish protocols. The documents most frequently mentioned by those who are interested in the theory of Jewish world power, rather than in the actual operation of that power in the world today, are those 24 documents known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. So this is what Henry Ford's researchers that he had right in the Dearborn Independent found about the protocols. The protocols have attracted much attention in Europe, having become the center of an important storm of opinion in England only recently, but discussion of them in the U.S. has been limited. These are the documents concerning which the Department of Justice was making inquiries more than a year ago, and which were given publication in London by Aaron Spottiswood, the official printers to the British government. Who it was that first entitled these documents with the name of the Elders of Zion is not known. It would be possible, without serious mutilation of the documents, to remove all hint of Jewish authorship and yet retain all the main points of the most comprehensive program for world subjugation. Comprehensive program for world subjugation that has ever come to public knowledge. So these are notes. It doesn't matter if you could erase the Jew part and they would still be the most comprehensive program for world subjugation that has ever been seen in the world. And remember last time in the first session we heard that the Department of Justice and the people who read it when it was in the U.S. thought that this was probably the work, these notes were coming from either a lecture by or written up by Theodor Herzl, the creator of Zionism. And again, Henry Ford's people writing in 1920 to 1922, before Israel exists. It comes to exist in 48, but of course they're filtering people in there for decades before that. So it would be possible, without serious mutilation of the documents, to remove all hint of Jewish authorship and yet retain all the main points of most comprehensive program for world subjugation that has ever come to public knowledge. Yet it must be said that thus to eliminate all hints of Jewish authorship would be to bring out a number of contradictions which do not exist in the protocols in their present form. The purpose of the plan revealed in the protocols is to undermine all authority in order that a new authority in the form of an autocracy, dictatorship, may be set up. So undermine all existing nations and authority and set up a new authority, an autocracy, the natural form of Jewish organization, as opposed to democracy. Such a plan could not emanate from a ruling class which already possessed authority, although it might emanate from anarchists. But anarchists do not avow autocracy as the ultimate condition they seek, by definition. Anarchy against government. The authors might be conceived as a company of French subversives, such as existed at the time of the French Revolution, and had the infamous Duc d'Orléans as their leader, but this would involve a contradiction between the fact that those subversives have passed away and the fact that the program announced in these protocols is being steadily carried out, not only in France, but throughout Europe, and very noticeably in the United States. In their present form, which bears evidence of being their original form, there is no contradiction. The allegation of Jewish authorship seems essential to the consistency of the plan. If these documents were the forgeries which Jewish apologists claim them to be, If they were the forgeries Jews claimed them to be, the forgers would probably have taken pains to make Jewish authorship so clear that their anti-Semitic purpose could easily have been detected. But only twice is the term Jew used in them. After one is read much further than the average reader usually cares to go into such matters, one comes upon the plans for the establishment of the world autocrat, and only then is it made clear of what lineage he is to be. But all through the documents there is left no doubt as to the people against whom the plan is aimed. It is not aimed against aristocracy as such. It is not aimed against capital as such. It is not aimed against government as such. So it's not against aristocracy, not against money, capital, not against government. Very definite provisions are made for the enlistment of aristocracy, capital, and government for the execution of the plan. It is aimed against the people of the world who are called Gentiles. In quotes. It is the frequent mention of, in quotes, Gentiles that really decides the purpose of the documents. Most of the destructive type of liberal, quote-unquote, plans aim at the enlistment of the people as helpers. This plan aims at the degeneration of the people in order that they may be reduced to confusion of mind and thus manipulated. Popular movements of a liberal kind are to be encouraged. All the disruptive philosophies and religion, economies, politics, and domestic life are to be sown and watered for the purpose of so disintegrating social solidarity that a definite plan herein set forth may be put through without notice, and the people molded to it when the fallacy of these philosophies is shown. And as I write, they're bringing millions and millions of Africans and Middle Easterners into Europe. That breaks up social solidarity. Of course, we have the Frankfurt School promoting of all kinds of sexual perversion at the same time. That, too, breaks up sexual solidarity, leads to mass confusion and mass tiredness with what's going on. And they say other places that tiredness and confusion lead the people to realize that there's no safe political opinion. Just stay out of it. Let them rule. And it prepares the way for someone to quiet all the hubbub, and that would be the world autocrat. The formula of speech is not, we Jews will do this, but the Gentiles will be made to think and do these things. With the exception of a few instances in the closing protocols, the only distinctive racial term used is Gentiles. The Gentiles will be made to think, this is how they put it. To illustrate the first indication of this kind comes in the first protocol in this way, quote, the great qualities of the people, honesty and frankness, are essentially vices in politics, because they dethrone more surely and more certainly than does the strongest enemy. These qualities are attributes of Gentile rule. We certainly must not be guided by them. And again, on the ruins of the hereditary aristocracy of the Gentiles, we have set up the aristocracy of our educated class, and overall the aristocracy of money. We have established the basis of this new aristocracy on the basis of riches, which we control, and on the science guided by our wise men. Again, we will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we at the same time will cause a rise in the price of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol, at the same time taking measures to drive all the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land. A forger with anti-Semitic malice might have written this at any time within the last 5 years, but these words were in print at least 14 years ago, according to British evidence, a copy having been in the British Museum since 1906, and they were circulated in Russia a number of years prior. The above point continues, quote, that the true situation shall not be noticed by the Gentiles prematurely, we will mask it by a pretended effort to serve the working classes and promote great economic principles, for which an attractive propaganda will be carried on through our economic theories. These quotations will illustrate the style of the protocols in making reference to the parties involved. It is we for the writers and Gentiles for those who are being written about. This is brought out very clearly in the 14th protocol. Remember, again, 24 protocols. World plan for taking power. Quote from the 14th protocol. In this divergence between the Gentiles and ourselves, inability to think and reason is to be seen clearly the seal of our election as the chosen people, as higher human beings, in contrast with the Gentiles who have merely instinctive and animal minds. They observe, but they do not foresee, and they invent nothing except perhaps material things. It is clear from this that nature herself predestined us to rule and guide the world. End quote. This, of course, has been the Jewish method of dividing humanity from the earliest times. The world was only Jew and Gentile. All that was not Jew was Gentile. The use of the word Jew in the protocol may be illustrated by this passage in the 8th section. For the time being, until it will be safe to give responsible government positions to our brother Jews, we shall entrust them to people whose past and whose characters are such that there is an abyss between them and the people. This, says Ford's people, is the practice known as using, quote, Gentile fronts, which is extensively practiced in the financial world today in order to cover up the evidences of Jewish control. How much progress has been made since those words were written is indicated by the occurrence at the San Francisco Convention when the name of Judge Brandeis was proposed for president, or Brandeis. It is reasonably to be expected that the public mind will be made more and more familiar with the idea of Jewish occupancy, and as I speak today, what is it, 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices are Jews, and the one proposed by Obama would be the 5th, I think. So the public becomes more and more familiar with the idea of Jewish occupancy, which will be a really short step from the present degree of influence which the Jews exercise, of the highest office in the government. There is no function of the American presidency in which the Jews have not already secretly assisted in a very important degree. Actual occupancy of the office is not necessary to enhance their power, but to promote certain things which parallel very closely the plans outlined in the protocols now before us. Another point which the reader of the protocols will notice is that the tone of exhortation is entirely absent from these documents. They are not propaganda. They are not efforts to stimulate the ambitions or activity of those to whom they are addressed. They are as cool as legal paper and as matter of fact as a table of statistics. There is none of the, let us rise, my brothers, stuff about them. There is no down with the Gentiles hysteria. These protocols, if indeed they were made by Jews and confided to Jews, or if they do contain certain principles of a Jewish world program, were certainly not intended for the firebrands, but for the carefully prepared and tested initiates of the higher groups. Okay, guys, here's what we're doing. Think of like a cop briefing or something. Jewish apologists have asked, is it conceivable that if there were such a world program on the part of the Jews, they would reduce it to writing and publish it? But there is no evidence that these protocols were ever uttered, otherwise than in spoken words, by those who put them forth. The protocols as we have them are apparently the notes of lectures which were made by someone who heard them. Some of them are lengthy, some of them are brief. The assertion which has always been made in connection with the protocols, since they have become known, is that they are the notes of lectures delivered to Jewish students, presumably somewhere in France or Switzerland. The attempt to make them appear to be of Russian origin is absolutely forestalled by the point of view, the references to the times, and certain grammatical indications. The tone certainly fits the supposition that they were originally lectures given to students, for their purpose is clearly not to get a program accepted, but to give information concerning a program which is represented as being already in process of fulfillment. There is no invitation to join forces or to offer opinions. Indeed, it is specifically announced that neither discussion nor opinions are desired. And then in parentheses to prove that, quoting, while preaching liberalism to Gentiles, we shall hold our own people and our own agents in unquestioning obedience. Fantastic pull quote there. This scheme of administration must emanate from a single brain. Therefore, we may know the plan of action, but we must not discuss it, lest we destroy its unique character. The inspired work of our leader, therefore, must not be thrown before a crowd to be torn to pieces, or even before a limited group. End those quotes. That demonstrate that neither discussion nor opinions are sought, and you can tell from the tone. He's not exhorting people, he's telling them how it is, and they're taking notes. And that's where the protocols apparently came from. Moreover, taking the protocols at their face value, it is evident that the program outlined in these lecture notes was not a new one at the time the lectures were given. There is no evidence of its being of recent arrangement. There is almost the tone of a tradition or a religion in it all, as if it had been handed down from generation to generation through the medium of specially trusted and initiated men. There is no note of new discovery or fresh enthusiasm in it, but the certitude and calmness of facts long known and policies long confirmed by experiment. This point of the age of the program is touched upon at least twice in the protocols themselves. In the first protocol, this paragraph occurs. Quote, already in ancient times, we were the first to shout the words liberty, equality, fraternity among the people. These words have been repeated many times since by unconscious poll parrots flocking from all sides to the bait, with which they have ruined the prosperity of the world and true personal freedom. The presumably clever and intelligent Gentiles did not understand the symbolism of the uttered words, did not observe their contradiction in meaning, did not notice that in nature there is no equality. The other reference to the program's finality is found in the 13th protocol. Quote, questions of policy, however, are permitted to no one except those who have originated the policy and have directed it for many centuries. Can this be reference to a secret Jewish Sanhedrin, such as, that's the meeting of the rabbis of the Jews, such as called by Napoleon, self-perpetuating within a certain Jewish caste from generation to generation, asks Ford. Again, it must be said that the originators and directors here referred to cannot be at present any ruling caste, for all that the program contemplates is directly opposed to the interests of such a caste. It cannot refer to any national aristocratic group like the Junkers of Germany, for the methods which are proposed are the very ones which would render powerless such a group. It cannot refer to any but a people who have no government, who have everything to gain and nothing to lose, and who can keep themselves intact amid a crumbling world. There is only one group that answers that description. Again, a reading of the protocols makes it clear that the speaker himself was not seeking for honor. There is a complete absence of personal ambition throughout the document. All plans and purposes and expectations are merged in the future of Israel, which future, it would seem, can only be secured by the subtle breaking down of certain world ideas held by the Gentiles. The protocols speak of what has been done, what was being done at the time these words were given, and what remained to be done. Nothing like them in completeness of detail, in breadth of plan, and in deep grasp of the hidden springs of human action, has ever been known. They are verily terrible in their mastery of the secrets of life, equally terrible in their consciousness of that mastery. Truly they would merit the opinion which Jews have recently cast upon them, that they were the work of an inspired madman, were it not that what is written in the protocols in words is also written upon the life of today in deeds and tendencies, he says, in 1920. The criticisms which these protocols pass upon the Gentiles for their stupidity are just. It is impossible to disagree with a single item in the protocol's description of Gentiles' mentality and veniality, their corruptibility. They're dumb and corruptible. They're easily bribed. They're easily fooled. They're gullible. Even the most astute of the Gentile thinkers have been fooled into receiving as the motions of progress what has only been insinuated into the common human mind by the most insidious systems of propaganda. It is true that here and there a thinker has arisen to say that the science, so-called, was not science at all. It is true that here and there a thinker has arisen to say that the so-called economic laws of both conservatives and radicals were not laws at all, but artificial inventions. It is true that occasionally a keen observer has asserted that the recent debauch of luxury and extravagance was not due to the natural impulses of the people at all, but was systematically stimulated, foisted upon them by design. He says this before the 20s were barely even started. They were famous like the 80s. They were characterized as a decade of greed and abandon and wildness and spending before the Great Depression set in. But whether or not that's accurate, just an observation. It is true that if you have discerned that more than half of what passes for public opinion is mere hired applause and booing has never impressed the public mind, but even with these clues here and there, for the most part disregarded, there has never been enough continuity and collaboration between those who were awake to follow all the clues to their source. The chief explanation of the hold which the protocols have had on many of the leading statesmen of the world for several decades is that they explain whence all these false influences come and what their purpose is. Oh, that's what's going on. They give a clue to the modern maze. It is now time for the people to know. And whether the protocols are judged as proving anything concerning the Jews or not, they constitute an education in the way the masses are turned about like sheep by influences which they do not understand. It is almost certain that once the principles of the protocols are known widely and understood by the people, the criticism which they now rightly make of the Gentile mind will no longer hold good. It is the purpose of future articles in this series to study these documents and to answer out of their contents all the questions that may arise concerning them. Before that work is begun, one question should be answered. Is there likelihood of the program of the protocols being carried through to success? The program is successful already. In many of its most important phases, it is already a reality. But this need not cause alarm, for the chief weapon to be used against such a program, both in its completed and uncompleted parts, is clear publicity. Let the people know. Arousing the people, alarming the people, appealing to the passions of the people is the method of the plan outlined in the protocols. The antidote is merely enlightening the people, Ford says in all caps. Essentially, talking about what's going on is enough to neutralize it. That is the only purpose of these articles. Enlightenment dispels prejudice. It is as desirable to dispel the prejudice of the Jew as of the Gentile. Jewish writers too frequently assume that the prejudice is all on one side. The protocols themselves ought to have the widest circulation among the Jewish people in order that they may check those things which are bringing suspicion upon their name. End of the article, and that appeared in the Dearborn Independent, Dearborn, Michigan, issue of July 24th, 1920. Very good article. Good Introduction to the Jewish Protocols was the name of that article. And we continue. Page 41 with How the Jewish Question Touches the Farm. Why would they include that in this book? Those wonderful documents known as the Protocols, with their strong grasp of every element of life, have not overlooked land. The land program is found in the sixth protocol, which is one of the briefest of the documents and may be quoted in full to show now the relation it bears to certain excerpts made in previous articles. Protocol 6, quote, "We shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the political catastrophe. The economist here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination. We must develop by every means the importance of our supergovernment, representing it as the protector and the benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. The aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away. We need not take them into consideration. But, as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are an independent in the sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. The best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. At the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land, both of laborers and capital, and, through speculations, transfer all the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol, at the same time taking measures to drive all the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land. That the true situation shall not be noticed by the Gentiles prematurely, we will mask it by a pretended effort to serve the working classes and promote great economic principles, for which an active propaganda will be carried on through our economic theories. The local and passing element in this is the aristocracy of the Gentiles. That is to say, the program is not entirely fulfilled by the passing of aristocrats. Jewry goes on just the same. Its program stretches far. Jewry will retain such kings as it desires, as long as it desires them. Probably the last throne to be vacated will be the British throne, because what to the British mind is the honor of being Jewry's protector, and therefore the inheritor of the blessing which that attitude brings, is to the Jewish mind the good fortune of being able to use a worldwide empire for the furtherance of Jewry's purpose. Each has served the other, and the partnership will probably last until Jewry gets ready to throw Britain over, which Jewry can do at almost any time. As I speak, Jews in Britain have said overtly within the last 5 years that the English aren't a race worth saving. They did nothing. They have admitted in the various papers that they simply elected a new people. They went out and they wouldn't hire native British, and they went out to find workers in the third world, brought them in, particularly brought in Muslims from Pakistan who have groomed, is the Jewish media term, i.e. gang-raped and pimped and prostituted white girls to the tune of 1,400 in one town. But the thing has been going on in towns up and down the British Isles. So that's the 2016 perspective on what this guy was writing in 1920. There are indications that it has already started on this last task, that is, throwing Britain over, which it can do at any time. But the permanent elements in this protocol are the land, the Jews, and the Gentiles. A word of explanation may be necessary on this inclusion of the Gentiles as permanent. The protocols do not contemplate the extermination of the Gentiles, nor the making of this world a completely Jewish-populated world. The protocols contemplate a Gentile world ruled by the Jews. The Jews as masters, the Gentiles as hewers of wood and drawers of water, a policy which every Old Testament reader knows to be typically Jewish and the source of divine judgment upon Israel time and again. Now look at this whole program as it concerns the land. Quote, owners of the land, dot, 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 are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. That is a foundation principle of the protocols. It matters not whether the owners are the Gentile aristocracy, the peasants of Poland, or the farmers of the United States. Land ownership makes the owners, quote, independent in their sources of livelihood. That is, they can raise food. And any form of independence is fatal to the success of the world program, which is written so comprehensively in the protocols, and which is advancing so comprehensively under Jewish guidance in the world of actual affairs today. Today being 1920. Not tillers of the land, not dwellers on the land, not tenants, not an agricultural peasantry, but owners of the land. This is the class singled out for attention in the sixth protocol, because they are, quote, independent in their sources of livelihood. That's what they want to get rid of. Now, there's been no time in history of the United States when apparently it was more easy for the farmer to own his land than now. Mortgages should be a thing of the past. Everywhere the propaganda of the question tells us that the farmers are growing, quote, rich. And yet there never were so many abandoned farms. Quote again, therefore, at all events, we must deprive them of their land. How? Quote, the best means to attain this is to increase land taxes and mortgage indebtedness, unquote. High taxes to keep the land at all, borrowed money to finance the tilling of it. Quote, these measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. We will leave it to the farmers in the U.S. to say whether this is working out or not, says Ford. And in a future reference to the subject, we will show that whenever an attempt is made to enable farmers to borrow money at decent rates, whenever it is proposed to lighten the burden of mortgage indebtedness on the farm, Jewish financial influence in the U.S. steps in to prevent it, or, failing to prevent it, mess it all up in the operation. By increasing the farmer's financial disability on the one hand, and by increasing industrial allurements on the other, a very great deal is accomplished. The protocol says, it is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and of capital. Has that been done? Have the farms of the U.S. been depleted of both laborers and capital? Certainly. Money is harder for the farmer to get than it is for any other man, and as for labor, he cannot get it on any terms. What is the result of these two influences, the one working on the farm and the other in the cities? It is precisely what the protocol says it will be. Increased wages that buy less of the materials of life. Quote, we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising. Unquote. The Jew who set these protocols in order was a financier, economist, and philosopher of the first order. He knew what he was talking about. His operations in the ordinary world of business always indicated that he knew exactly what he was doing. How well the sixth protocol has worked and is still working out in human affairs is before the eyes of everyone to see. Here in the U.S., one of the most important movements toward real independence of the financial powers has been begun, independence of the financial powers has been begun by the farmers. The farmer's strong advantage is that, owning the land, he is independent in his sources of livelihood. The land will feed him whether he pleases international Jewish financiers or not. His position is impregnable as long as the sun shines and the seasons roll. It was therefore necessary to do something to hinder this budding independence. He was placed under a greater disadvantage than any other businessman in borrowing capital. He was placed more ruthlessly than any other producer between the upper and nether stones of a thievish distribution system. Labor was drawn away from the farm. The Jew-controlled melodrama made the farmer a rube, and Jew-made fiction presented him as a hick, causing his sons to be ashamed of farm life. The grain syndicates which operate against the farmer are Jew-controlled. There is no longer any possibility of doubting, when the facts of actual affairs are put alongside the written program, that the farmer of the U.S. has an interest in this question. What would this world program gain if the wage workers were enslaved and the farmers were allowed to go scot-free? Therefore, the program of agricultural interference, which has been only partially outlined here, but this is not all. Any writer who attempts fully to inform the Gentile mind on the Jewish question must often feel that the extent of the Protocol's conspiracy is so great as to stagger the Gentile mind. Gentiles are not conspirators. They cannot follow a clue through long and devious and darkened channels. The elaborate completeness of the Jewish program, the perfect coordination of its massive details, wearies the Gentile mind. This, really more than the daring of the program itself, constitutes the principal danger of the program being fulfilled. That is just too much for us gullible goyim to follow, because we don't think that way, and it's wearying to us to try. Gentile mental laziness is the most powerful ally the world program has. Another great pull quote. And I'm pausing, you don't know it, but I'm pausing to tweet some of these. Follow me on Twitter. Gentile mental laziness is the most powerful ally the world program has. For example, after citing the perfectly obvious coincidence and most probable connection between the protocols and the observable facts with reference to the farm situation, the writer is compelled to say, as above, quote, "But this is not all," unquote. And it is a peculiarity of Gentile psychology that the Gentile reader will feel that it ought to be all because it is so complete. This is where the Jewish mind outmaneuvers the Gentile mind. Gentiles may do a thing for one reason. The Jew often does the same thing for three or four reasons. The Gentile can understand thus far why Jewish financiers should seek to control the land in order to prevent widespread agricultural independence, which, as Protocol 6 says, would be harmful to us. End quotes. That reason is perfectly clear, but there is another. It is found in the 12th Protocol. It contemplates nothing less than the playing of city against country in the great game now being exposed. Complete control over the city by the industrial leverage and over the country by the debt leverage will enable the hidden players to move first the country by saying that the city demands certain things, and then move the city by saying that the country demands certain things, thus splitting citizen and farmers apart and using them against one another. Look at the plainness and the boldness, yet the calm assurance with which this plan is broached. Quote, "Our calculations reach out, especially into the country districts. There we must necessarily arouse those interests and ambitions which we can always turn against the city, representing them to the cities as dreams and ambitions for independence on the part of the provinces. It is clear that the source of this will be precisely the same, and it will come from us. It will be necessary for us, before we have attained full power, to so arrange matters that, from time to time, the city shall come under the influence of opinion in the country districts, that is, of the majority prearranged by our agents." Ford again, "The preliminaries of the game are here set forth. To jockey city and farm against each other, that in the end the conspirators may use whichever proves the stronger in putting the plan over. In Russia, both schemes have been worked." And again, this is before they did the dramatic mass political starvation in the Ukraine. "The old regime, established in the cities, was persuaded to lay down power because it was made to believe that the peasants of Russia requested it. Then, when the Bolshevists seized power, they ruled the peasantry on the ground that the cities wanted it. The cities listened to the country, and now the country is listening to the cities. If you see any attempt made to divide city and farm into antagonistic camps, remember this paragraph from the 12th Protocol. Already the poison is working." How is it today? You know, the Jews ended free association, initiated forced association, which they called integration in a typical gaslighting term that inverts reality, because where blacks are mixed with whites, it destroys things. But this led to blacks dominating politically, along with demographic change over time, dominating the big city, so that a lot of the states now have this urban-rural thing where the blacks and the leftists dominate the big cities and the whites dominate the rural areas, and they're at odds. Have you never heard that prohibition was something which the backwoods districts forced upon the cities? Have you never heard that the high cost of living was done or was due to extravagant profits of the farmer? Profits which he doesn't even get. One big dent in this program of world control could be made if the citizen and the farmer could learn each other's mind, not through self-appointed spokesmen, but directly from each other. Internet could help in that, huh? Of course, this was written, he wrote that line 75 years before the internet became mainstream, choosing 1995 as that date. City and farm are drifting apart because of misrepresentation of outsiders, and in the widening rift, the sinister shadow of the world program appears. Let the farmers look past the Gentile fronts in their villages or principal trading points, past them to the real controllers who are hidden. This appeared on the 4th of September, 1920, that article on the farm and how that fits the world program. So the Jews don't want anyone having an independent livelihood. That way they can exert complete political control. And we move on to the next article, which is Dr. Levy, a Jew, admits his people's error. A Jew of standing, Dr. Oscar Levy, well known in English literary circles and a lover of his people, has had the honesty and the wisdom to meet the Jewish question with truth and candor. His remarks are printed in this article as an example of the methods by which Jewry can be saved in the estimation of 20th century civilization. The circumstances were these. George Pitt Rivers, hyphenated, of Worcester College, Oxford, wrote a most illuminating brochure entitled The World Significance of the Russian Revolution, which is published and sold for 2 shillings by Basil Blackwell, Oxford. The book is the result of unprejudiced observation and study and agrees with the statements made in the Dearborn Independent about the personnel of Bolshevism. The manuscript was sent to Dr. Oscar Levy as a representative Jew, and Dr. Levy's letter was subsequently published as a preface to the book. That the reader may understand the tenor of Mr. Pitt Rivers' book, section 16, pages 39 to 41, is herewith given in full and is followed by Dr. Levy's comments. The italics throughout are intended to remind the reader of remarks on similar lines made in this series. It is not unnaturally claimed by Western Jews that Russian Jewry as a whole is most bitterly opposed to Bolshevism. Now, although there is a great measure of truth in this claim, since the prominent Bolsheviks, who are preponderantly Jewish, do not belong to the Orthodox Jewish Church, it is yet possible, without laying oneself open to the charge of anti-Semitism, to point to the obvious fact that Jewry as a whole, consciously or unconsciously, worked for and promoted an international economic material despotism which, with Puritanism as an ally, has tended in an ever-increasing degree to crush national and spiritual values out of existence and substitute the ugly and deadening machinery of finance and factory. It is also a fact that Jewry as a whole strove every nerve to secure and heartily approved of the overthrow of the Russian monarchy, which they regarded as their most formidable obstacle in the path of their ambitions and business pursuits. All this may be admitted, as well as the plea that, individually or collectively, most Jews may heartily detest the Bolshevik regime, yet it is still true that the whole weight of Jewry was in the revolutionary scales against the Tsar's government. It is true their apostate brethren, who are now riding in the seat of power, may have exceeded their orders. That is disconcerting, but it does not alter the fact. It may be that the Jews, often the victims of their own idealism, have always been instrumental in bringing about the events they most heartily disapprove of. That perhaps is the curse of the wandering Jew. Certainly it is from the Jews themselves that we learn the most about Jews. It is possible that only a Jew can understand a Jew. Sort of a Pierce type of point, William Pierce. That different racial mentalities are not mutually intelligible. I think Pierce pushed that a little far, but it's the greater danger is that because it's much more common and leads to terrible errors, is that we think that others think like us when they don't think like us. Nay more, it may be only that a Jew can save us from the Jews, a Jew who is great enough, strong enough, for greater racial purity is a source of strength in the rare and the great, and inspired enough to overcome in himself the life-destructive vices of his own race. It was a Jew who said, "Wars are the Jews' harvest." But no harvest so rich as civil wars. A Jew reminds us that the French Revolution brought civil emancipation for the Jews in Western Europe, that it let them out of the shtetl, out of the ghetto, gave them full citizenship rights. Was it a Jew who inspired Rousseau with the 18th century idea of the sameness of man according to nature? Dr. Callan, a Zionist author, the guy who created the concept of multiculturalism, I think, there are other Jews named Callan, writes, "Suffering for 1,000 years from the assertion of their difference from the rest of mankind, they accepted eagerly the escape from suffering which the 18th century assertion of the sameness of all men opened to them. They threw themselves with passion into the republican, emancipating movements of their fellow subjects of other stocks." Unquote. It was a Jew, Ricardo, who gave us the 19th century ideal of the sameness of man according to machinery. And without the Ricardian gospel of international capitalism, we could not have had the international gospel of Karl Marx. Moses Hess and Disraeli remind us of the particularly conspicuous part played by Jews in the Polish and Hungarian rebellions and in the Republican uprising of Germany in 1848. Even more conspicuous were they in the new internationalism, logically deductible from the philosophy of socialism. This we were taught by the Jew Marx and the Jew Ferdinand LaSalle, and they but developed the doctrine of the Jew David Ricardo, British economist. It was Weininger, a Jew, and also a Jew hater, who explained why so many Jews are naturally communists. Communism is not only an international creed, but it implies the abnegation of real property, especially property in land, and Jews, being international, have never acquired a taste for real property. They prefer money. Now that does not date well to today's world. Money is an instrument of power, though eventually, of course, communists claim that they will do away with money when their power is sufficiently established to enable them to command goods and exercise despotic control without it. Thus the same motives prompt the Jew communist and his apparent enemy, the financial Jew. Two different parties, one agenda. When owners of real property in times of economic depression feel the pinch of a straitened circumstances, it is the Jewish usurers who become most affluent and who, out of the goodness of their hearts, come to their assistance at a price. To these and other statements, Dr. Levy as a Jew made this reply. "Dear Mr. Pitt Rivers, when you first handed me your manuscript on the world significance of the Russian Revolution, you expressed a doubt about the propriety of its title. After a perusal of your work, I can assure you with the best of consciences that your misgivings were entirely without foundation. No better title than the World Significance of the Russian Revolution could have been chosen, for no event in any age will finally have more significance for our world than this one. We are still too near to see clearly this revolution, this portentous event, which was certainly one of the most intimate and therefore least obvious aims of the world conflagration, hidden as it was by the fire and smoke of national enthusiasms and patriotic antagonisms. It was certainly very plucky of you to try and throw some light upon an event which necessarily must still be enveloped in mist and mystery. and I was even somewhat anxious, lest your audacity in treating such a dangerous subject would end in failure, or what is nearly the same, in ephemeral success. No age is so voracious of its printed offspring as ours. There was, thus, some reason to fear lest you had offered to this modern Chronos only another mouthful of his accustomed nourishment for his immediate consumption. Now, I figured you might have written some light and trivial thing, but that, I'm glad to say that's not the case, the Jew is saying. I was, I am glad to report, agreeably surprised. Surprised, though, not by the many new facts which you give, and which must surprise all those who take an interest in current events. Facts, I believe, which you have carefully and personally collected and selected, not only from books, but from the lips and letters of Russian eyewitnesses and sufferers, from foes as well as from friends of the Great Revolution. What I appreciate more than this new light thrown on the dark subject, more than the conclusion drawn by you from this wealth of facts, is the psychological insight which you display in detecting the reasons why a movement so extraordinarily bestial and so violently crazy as the revolution was able to succeed and finally to overcome its adversaries. For we are confronted with two questions which need answering and which, in my opinion, you have answered in your pamphlet. These questions are, 1. How is the Soviet government, admittedly the government of an insignificant minority, succeeded not only in maintaining but in strengthening its position in Russia after 2.5 years in power? And 2. Why is the Soviet government, in spite of its outward bestiality and brutal tyranny, succeeded in gaining the sympathies of an increasing number of people in this country, Great Britain? You rightly recognize that there is an ideology behind it, and you clearly diagnose it as an ancient ideology. There is nothing new under the sun. It is even nothing new that the sun rises in the east. For Bolshevism is a religion and a faith. How could these half-converted believers ever dream to vanquish the truthful and the faithful, both in quotes, of their own creed, these holy crusaders who had gathered round the red standard of the prophet Karl Marx and who fought under the daring guidance of experienced officers of all latter-day revolution, the Jews? I am touching here on a subject which, to judge from your own pamphlet, is perhaps more interesting to you than any other. In this you are right. There is no race in the world more enigmatic, more fatal, and therefore more interesting than the Jews. Every writer who, like yourself, is oppressed by the aspect of the present and embarrassed by his anxiety for the future must try to elucidate the Jewish question and its bearing upon our age, must in capital letters. For the question of the Jews and their influence on the world past and present cuts to the root of all things and should be discussed by every honest thinker, however bristling with difficulties it is, however complex the subject as well as the individuals of this race may be. For the Jews, as you are aware, are a sensitive community, and thus very suspicious of any Gentile who tries to approach them with a critical mind. They are always inclined, and on that account of their terrible experiences, to denounce anyone who is not with them as against them, as tainted with, quote, medieval, unquote, prejudice, as an intolerant antagonist of their faith and of their race. Nor could or would I deny that there is some evidence, some prima facie evidence, of this antagonistic attitude in your pamphlet. You point out, and with fine indignation, the great danger that springs from the prevalence of Jews in finance and industry, and from the preponderance of Jews in rebellion and revolution. You reveal, and with great fervor, the connection between the collectivism of the immensely rich international finance, the democracy of cash values, as you call it, and the international collectivism of Karl Marx and Trotsky, the democracy of and by de Kreukris. I'm not sure what that is. Probably a misspelling, but and all this evil and misery, the economic as well as the political, you trace back to one source, to one fonset origo malorum, one fount and source of evil, the Jews. Now other Jews may vilify and crucify you, this Jew is saying, for those outspoken views of yours. I myself shall abstain from joining the chorus of condemnation. I shall try to understand your opinions and your feelings, and having once understood them, as I think I have, I can defend you from the unjust attacks of my often too impetuous race. But first of all, I have to say this. There is scarcely an event in modern Europe that cannot be traced back to the Jews. Take the Great War. That appears to have come to an end, and ask yourself, what were its causes and its reasons? You will find them in nationalism. You will at once answer that nationalism has nothing to do with the Jews, who, as you believe you have proved to us, are the inventors of the international idea. But no less than Bolshevist ecstasy and financial tyranny can national bigotry, if I may so call it, capital N, capital B is his Jewish term for nationalism, be finally followed back to a Jewish source. Are not they the inventors of the chosen people myth? And is not this obsession part and parcel of the political credo of every modern nation, however small and insignificant it may be? And then think of the history of nationalism. It started in our time and as a reaction against Napoleon. Napoleon was the antagonist of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was the consequence of the German Reformation. The German Reformation was based upon a crude Christianity. This kind of Christianity was invented, preached, and propagated by the Jews. Therefore, the Jews have made this war. Please do not think this a joke. It only seems a joke, and behind it there lurks a gigantic truth. And it is this, that all Latter-day ideas and movements have originally sprung from a Jewish source. For the simple reason that the Semitic idea has finally conquered and entirely subdued this only apparently irreligious universe of ours. There is no doubt that the Jews regularly go one better or worse than the Gentile in whatever they do. There is no further doubt that their influence today justifies a very careful scrutiny and cannot possibly be viewed without serious alarm. The great question, however, is whether the Jews are conscious or unconscious malefactors. I myself am firmly convinced that they are unconscious ones, but please do not think that I wish to exonerate them on that account. A conscious evildoer has my respect, for he knows at least what is good. An unconscious one, well, he needs the charity of Christ, a charity which is not mine, to be forgiven for not knowing what he is doing. But there is in my firm conviction not the slightest doubt that these revolutionary Jews do not know what they are doing, that they are more unconscious sinners than voluntary evildoers. I think that's absurd. I am glad to see any talk of self-deception in Jews, to my mind, is very, very misleading and dishonest, as well as simply just wrong. I'm glad to see that this is not an original observation of mine, but that you yourself have a very strong foreboding about the Jews being the victims of their own theories and principles. On page 39 of your pamphlet, you write, "It may be that the Jews have always been instrumental in bringing about the events that they most heartily disapprove of. That maybe this is the curse of the wandering Jew. If I had not the honor as well as the pleasure of knowing you personally, if I were not strongly aware of your passionate desire for light and your intense loathing of unfairness, this sentence, and the sentence alone, which tells the truth, will absolve you in my eyes from the odious charge of being a vulgar anti-Semite." No, you are not a vulgar, you are a very enlightened critic of our race. For there is an anti-Semitism, I hope and trust, which does the Jews more justice than any blind philo-Semitism, than does merely sentimental let-them-all-come liberalism, which in itself is nothing but the Semitic ideology over again. And thus, you can be just to the Jews without being romantic about them. You have noticed with alarm that the Jewish elements provide the driving force for both communism and capitalism. Echoing Churchill's words. But then you have at the same time the profound suspicion that the real reason all of this extraordinary behavior may be the intense idealism of the Jew. In this, you are perfectly right. The Jew, if caught by an idea, never thinks any more in watertight compartments, as do the Teuton and Anglo-Saxon people, whose right cerebral hemisphere never seems to know what is in its left twin brother is doing. He, the Jew, like the Russian, at once begins to practice what he preaches. He draws the logical conclusion from his tenets. He invariably acts upon his accepted principles. It is from this quality, no doubt, that springs his mysterious force, that force which you no doubt condemn, but which you had to admire even in the Bolsheviks. And we must admire it, whether we are Jews or whether we are Christians, for if not these modern Jews remain true to type, is there no parallel for them in history? Do they not go to the bitter end, even in our day? Who stirred up the people during the late war in Germany? Who pretended to have again the truth? That truth about which Pontius Pilate once again shrugged his shoulders. Who pleaded for honesty and cleanliness in politics, that honesty which brings a smile to the lips of any experienced proconsul of today? Writers who were mostly Jews. Fried, Fernow, Latzko, Richard Grelling, the author of J'accuse, I accuse, who was killed and allowed himself to be killed for these very simple Who was killed and allowed himself to be killed for these very ideas and principles? Men and women of the Jewish race. Haase, Levine, Luxemburg, Landauer, Kurt Eisner, the Prime Minister of Bavaria. From Moses to Marx, from Isaiah to Eisner, in practice and in theory, in idealism and in materialism, in philosophy and in politics, they are today what they have always been, passionately devoted to their aims and to their purposes. And ready, nay, eager to shed their last drop of blood for the realization of their visions. But these visions are all wrong, will you reply? Look at where they have led the world to. Think that they have now had a fair trial of 3,000 years standing. How much longer are you going to recommend them to us and to inflict them upon us? And how do you propose to get us out of the morass into which you have led the world so disastrously astray? To this question I have only one answer to give, says the Jew, and it is this. You are right. This reproach of yours, which I feel for certain is at the bottom of your anti-Semitism, is only too well justified, and upon this common ground I am quite willing to shake hands with you and defend you against any accusation of promoting race hatred. If you are anti-Semite, I, the Semite, am an anti-Semite too, and a much more fervent one than even you. We Jews have erred, my friend. We have most grievously erred. And if there was truth in our error 3,000, 2,000, nay, 100 years ago, there is now nothing but falseness and madness, a madness that will produce an even greater misery and an even wider anarchy. I confess it to you openly and sincerely, and with a sorrow whose depth and pain an ancient psalmist, and only he, could moan into this burning universe of ours. We who have posed as the saviors of the world, we who have even boasted of having given it the savior, we are today nothing else but the world's seducers, its destroyers, its incendiaries, its executioners. We who have promised to lead you to a new heaven, we have finally succeeded in landing you into a new hell. There has been no progress, least of all moral progress. And it is just our morality which has prohibited all real progress, and what is worse, which even stands in the way of every future and natural reconstruction in this ruined world of ours. I look at this world and I shudder at its ghastliness. I shudder all the more as I know the spiritual authors of this ghastliness. But its authors themselves, unconscious in this as in all they are doing, know nothing yet of this startling revelation. While Europe is aflame, while its victims scream, while its dogs howl in the conflagration, and while its very smoke descends in darker and even darker shades upon our continent, the Jews, or at least a part of them and by no means the most unworthy ones, endeavor to escape from the burning building and wish to retire from Europe into Asia, from the somber scene of our disaster into the sunny corner of Palestine. Their eyes are closed to the miseries, their ears are deaf to the moaning, their heart is hardened to the anarchy of Europe. They only feel their own sorrows. They only bewail their own fate. They only sigh under their own burdens. They know nothing of their duty to Europe, which looks around in vain for help and guidance. They know nothing even of their own great ancestor, to whose heart the appeal of pity was never made in vain. They have become too poor in love, too sick at heart, too tired of battle, and lo, these sons of those who were once the bravest of soldiers are now trying to retire from the trenches to the rear, are now eager to exchange the grim music of the whistling shells with that of the cowbells and vintage songs in the happy plain of Sharon. Having burned Europe down, they're now running away. They're now becoming Zionists. Having made the misery of international communism, they're now going for national socialism in Israel. And yet, we are not all financiers. We are not all Bolshevists. We have not all become Zionists. And yet there is hope, great hope, that this same race which has provided the evil will likewise succeed in supplying its antidote, its remedy, the good. It has always been so in the past. Was not that fatal liberalism which has finally led to Bolshevism, in the very midst of the dark 19th century, most strenuously opposed by two enlightened Jews, Friedrich Stahl, the founder of the Conservative Party in Germany, and by Benjamin Disraeli, the leader of the Tory Party in England? And if these two eminent men had no suspicion yet that their own race and its holy message were at the bottom of that unfortunate upheaval with which their age was confronted, how eager, how determined, how passionate will be the opposition of the Disraelis of the future once they have clearly recognized that they are really fighting the tenets of their own people, and that it was their good, their love, their ideal, that had launched the world into this new hell of evil and hatred. A new good as new love, a true love, an intelligent love, a love that calms and heals and sweetens, will then spring up among the great in Israel and overcome that sickly love, that insipid love, that romantic love, which has hitherto poisoned all the strength and the nobility of this world. For hatred is never overcome by hatred. It is only overcome by love, and it wants a new and gigantic love to subdue that old and devilish hatred of today. That is our task for the future. A task which will, I am sure, not be shirked by Israel, by that same Israel which has never shirked a task, whether it was for good or whether it was for evil. Yes, there is hope, my friend, for we are still here. Our last word is not yet spoken. Our last deed is not yet done. Our last revolution is not yet made. This last revolution, the revolution that will crown our revolutionaries, will be the revolution against the revolutionaries. It is bound to come, and it is perhaps upon us now. The great day of reckoning is near. It will pass a judgment upon our ancient faith, and it will lay the foundation to a new religion. And when that great day is broken, when the values of death and decay are put into the melting pot to be changed into those of power and beauty, then you, my dear Pitt Rivers, the descendant of an old and distinguished Gentile family, may be assured to find by your side, and as your faithful ally, at least one member of that Jewish race which has fought with such fatal success upon all the spiritual battlefields of Europe. Yours against the revolution and for life ever flourishing, Oscar Levy, Royal Society's Club, St. James Street, London, Southwest, July 1920. And that was published in the Dearborn Independent, April 30th, 1921. And so they give wide space in the Dearborn Independent to a Jew admitting the main charges against his own race. The rare honest Jew, Fordwood says. Anyway, that's the ground we need to cover today, so we'll leave it there. And in session three, we'll resume on page 61 and with the last few articles, I think it is, from the Dearborn Independent. Thanks for being with me. You can find this and everything we do at vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again real soon.